Chuck O'Kelly.
23rd day of September 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And right away, we start off with a little bit of a technical issue. So, Dr. Walt Brown will be with me in this hour, I assure you, and there will be an interesting presentation. But in the second hour, I just may have to go off all by myself and do something else. So that's going to be a remix on the today and yesterday's podcast is going to come out later tonight or early tomorrow. You'll have both of them out. But Dr. Brown, I'm going to have to try and get him back on the phone. I just lost him as I was going to live air, which is why if you're on the live stream, most of you aren't. But when you are on the live stream, you might recognize that I went to air just slightly late. And I'm going to play a little something from Cirrus Minor and try and raise Walt back on the phone. So stick around. This is Cirrus Minor. It's called I'll Be All Right. Ocelli.com. We are live, and we are getting to it on a Wednesday. Stick around. Lava. So we didn't have to play that much of the song here on the stream. You know, this is Wednesday, the middle of the week, hump day, Woden's day, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of times, I'll tell you, it gets weird. Now, somebody who is not weird is my guest, Dr. Walt Brown. Walt Brown, PhD. I don't mean he's a medical doctor, because if he was, I'd probably be asking him a lot of questions about what's going on in the world today. Instead, though, I want to tell you that he is a prolific and profoundly interesting author, writing on everything from, you know, a lot of people know him from the JFK case, of course, but quite frankly, he's written mystery novels. He's written about John Adams. He's written about the world wars, if you will. A chronology on JFK, the largest chronology, one of the ones that I bring up all the time. I don't know how it is you can cover anything more than what Dr. Brown covered in 30,000 pages, I think. A 3,000-page index, the JFK chronology, which is available on Amazon and all those other wonderful places. In fact, he just told me it's also available on the in the Apple Store now, whatever they're calling it, because they keep changing it. It's available there as well. But anyway, I mean, a bunch of books on the Kennedy assassination, including the Kennedy execution, and one of my favorites, Judith Berry Baker, in her own words. Which, you know, we might have to touch on some of those subjects tonight. Thankfully, he's back with me on the phone, if technology's allowing it. Anyway, Dr. Brown, first of all, let everybody know. I'm laughing because, of course, I go to air and you're gone, and we couldn't figure out why, but I got you back. And first of all, how you doing tonight, sir?
Well, I'm doing well for an elderly 73-year-old who has to put on a mask to go get the mail. It's been a siege. It's been horrible. And 200 yards from where I'm sitting, there's a senior citizen home where 31 people died in 1 week. Mm. It's been nasty. Vis-a-vis the chronology, it is available on the ebook platforms, but it's also available from me more cheaply on a CD-ROM. And it's done well, along with Kennedy Execution and Judy. But I also did a chronology on the World Wars, which you mentioned, and now I'm doing a chronology on the New York Yankees from the day I was born up. And I finished 1981 today, so we've done 34 years.
Well, that's a lot.
It's almost 2,000 pages, almost a million words, but it's every day and something to do until I start the next mystery novel.
Listen, I hear you, but I'm going to confess one thing, Walt. I am not going to buy the Yankees chronology from you because guess what? You might know this. You might remember this. I'm a Mets fan, right? So,
well, you know what my license plate is, right?
I do remember it has something to do with it. The interesting plate on the red car, I know is somehow Mets related, is it not?
Yeah, it's that car's gone, but it's the number 2 and the word Mets.
Yeah.
somebody grabbed me today in the pet food store and said, oh, you must be the Mets fan. That's your Corvette out there. I said, well, I went to spring training with the Mets once, and the rest is history. But that's another story for another time. But I lived amidst the Yankees growing up here in Hillsdale, where I've only lived since 51. Mm. But I'm getting used to the place.
Well, you know, since 51, only since then, that's hilarious.
As you know, we've had some good times, some good JFK times here, but now nothing doing.
Yeah,
what's going on outside?
Well, you know, I was going to actually ask you about that, if you don't mind for a second, because, you know, there used to be, when I did not attend conferences at all, I did not go, generally speaking. I mean, I went, you know, in 2003 to Pittsburgh.
That was a great conference.
Well, right. I mean, but that was special. That was an exceptional thing. You know what I mean? And I presented at Lancer in 2017, but other than that, I mean, I have not been to very many conferences because I just didn't want to get involved. I'll tell you the truth. I've been to what you used to call, you know, like Dealey Plaza in Hillsdale or whatever it was.
Dallas and Hillsdale.
I've been to your house more often than I've been to a JFK conference, and it's funny. I used to be one of those guys at Walt's house. I've known more than one white dog in the house, you know?
Yes, you have.
How is Casper doing, by the way?
Well, he's 10 years old. He's doing as well as he can. We're both about the same age now.
Oh, you know,
yeah,
that's true.
I miss the conferences, but I don't miss the confrontations. I sat down one night and wrote a list of the ones that I went to, and I was really, really kind of astounded that I went to that many. But along the way, I gave 12 keynotes, and I'm very proud of that. And the last conference, I had an all expense paid to Las Vegas. I was the only speaker at the Mob Museum, which is an incredible museum.
Right.
It's where Estes Kefauver held the mob hearings in 1951, mm-hmm. and they've turned it into a museum of organized crime, and they have some incredible stuff there. And they invited me out, and my first question was, who else is speaking? They said, no, just you. I said, okay. So when I got there the day before, I said, how many people usually come to these things? They said, oh, maybe 30. I said, 30 people? You paid airfare, car service, room, the whole deal, 30 people. They got 150. Mm. So it worked out. And it was a fun night, I got to tell you. We had a ball that night. I don't think I'll ever have as much fun at a conference as I had at that one. So I don't miss going to them. I can't leave Casper alone either. So that's the other thing.
You know, here's a funny thing too, is that, you were one of these guys, and especially when you were working on the JFK, you know, the chronology. I would call you up, sometimes, cause I didn't just show up, you know, in November at your house. Sometimes I would just call you up, you know, see how things were going or whatever. And it was really fun because any day it was, you would tell me something about the day it was. You know, matter. And I'll tell you a funny thing. I bet you, here's something that I bet you did not know. Now, you probably know that Joey Gallo, you know, you remember Crazy Joe Gallo, right?
Sure.
Okay, so as a mob historian of sorts, Walt, here's the thing. You know what day he was killed, probably, because you're one of these guys with dates. You know, I share a birthday with Joey Gallo. And I was born the same day Joe Gallo was killed. You like that one?
Well, I was born the day that Mother Teresa took her vows. So that's not exactly a win-win, but it's one of those things. Hmm. And Brian Rooney, whom you met here, who has since passed 2 years ago, he was born the day that Bugsy Siegel was gunned down in Vegas. So we both had something working there. But, yeah, no, the chronology, you know, you were always asking dates, but anytime anybody called, the first thing would be, hi, Walt, how many pages? And I knew it was a Kennedy call. And for anybody that's curious about, you know, thinking about doing a chronology, I spent 7.5 years on that, and I had 40 days off altogether in 7.5 years because I had to keep everything right in front of me. I had to have my desktop, my personal desktop, in my head just totally focused, and I wouldn't want to do that again now. I finished it 10, 11 years ago, but I started it in 05. So, as a memory for Jay Harrison.
Right.
And I never thought it would get to 30,000 pages. When I physically just couldn't do any more, Brian Rooney said, well, why don't you start indexing it? I said, yeah, that's an idea. And it took 8 months to do the multi-thousand page index, which is annotated, but you don't get the index from Kindle or those things because there's no pages in the platforms. The right. CD has pages in it and it's indexed.
Right, and I've actually gotten, I have a copy of the CD somewhere here, actually probably within an arm's length of where I'm sitting. And quite frankly, it is an essential tool. If you want to understand a lot of the context behind many of the characters, I got to tell you, there's a lot of things about this that are really deep. Plus, you know, it's not a big old dry read, which I appreciate. Now, if people were aware of the Deep Politics Quarterly, there's a bit of a humor, sarcasm, and occasionally sardonic sort of commentary that goes in there. And you know, I know many people contributed, but Walt is kind of a unique writer in that way. So even though it is this huge task to read the chronology, and you can take it in different sections and do different things with it, I just want to remind people that, you know, it is well worth it. It is out there. And they can contact you at your email address, actually, to hook up with you about it. Which email address would you like them to use before we get into tonight's topic?
WriteNroll, write and roll, like rock and roll, at AOL.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to...
I would suspect it. And a number of people have contacted me that read the whole thing. And I would suspect that if you sit down and decide I'm going to take a year or two of my spare time to read it, you will learn a minimum of 10,000 things you didn't know. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that would be a generous assessment. And by the way, in the show notes tonight, when I'm done, I'm going to not only include the email address to contact Walt, but also I would very much encourage you guys to get Judith Berry Baker in her own words, which and I'll even give you the P.O. box and everything if you want to send a money order, you don't want to deal with electronic stuff or whatever, in order to order it, you can get a physical copy and actually signed if you like. From Walt directly.
It's not signed by Judy.
no, it's not by Judy, although we have to point out that you use her own words and compare it with...
No. She's essentially the co-author, but as you said, a sardonic way.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, you know, that story begs for wit and sarcasm because you... And I've had people tell me that they read it and they loved it, but it took them 2 months to read a small book because they'd read 10 pages and just feel nauseous about the whole thing and put it aside and then go back to it. And I got to get deeper into this story. And the deeper they got, the more they stayed with it.
By the way, are you still selling those for $20 in the U.S.? Like if people want to get one?
Yeah, it's $21.95 on Amazon, but... through me, it's 20, simply because I don't have to pay the VIG to Amazon.
Right. No, I just want to make sure people know that. I think it's a great Christmas gift, people. How about that? Anyway.
Absolutely. That's the ultimate stocking stuffer because she isn't.
There you have it. So tonight you had an idea, and I want to just sort of shut up and let you run with it a little bit because this is interesting. What is the main focus of the, you know, mythological narrative from Ms. Baker? Well, it's Lee Harvey Oswald, and you have a very interesting concept that you told me about just a little while ago. And I would love to just sort of turn it over to you and see how much of it we can get through. here in an hour. If you want to go a little longer, we can do that. But, you know, because I can choose when we take a break or whatever. But fact is, I would love to hear what you have to say here. And what did you exactly title it? Now, I vaguely remember because, you know, had my hands full figuring out stuff. But
essentially, the exceptional Lee Oswald, because there are so many instances from birth to death where bizarre exceptions were made, most cases by somebody else, occasionally by him. Mm. But things were done that just scream for an explanation. You know, how did that happen? Why did it happen? Or who made it happen, kind of thing. Some of them are kind of simple. Some of them strange. You know, some of them belong in Ripley's Believe It or Not, if anybody remembers that. Start with, there's a lot of confusion about Oswald's birth certificate. Supposedly, he had to take it to a school. When he left the school, he was supposed to bring it home. It's not known for certain even where he was born, home or hospital. And at some point, as I'm sure most of the listeners know, Hoover put out a memo in 1960, about a month after the U2, that someone, person unknown, might be using Oswald's birth certificate. Now, how they got it, where they got it, who knows? But it makes no sense. Nobody's ever used mine. I don't think anybody ever want to. As he was going through school, and this is a thank you and a hat tip to John Armstrong, there are a number of cases where Oswald was going to a school district, let's say school district 8 in Fort Worth or New Orleans or wherever mama took him. And you have a letter written by his mother, postmarked on a certain day, we'll call it September 23rd, I don't know, 1950, from an address that's in District 1, and he's going to school in District 8. And there's too many of them to just say, wait a minute, how do you do that? You're supposed to go to school where you live. A lot of times he didn't. Of course, a lot of times he didn't go to school. Sometimes, as you'll see, he went double. He had a string of jobs before he went into the Marine Corps and after he came back from his accidental tourist trip. The bosses he had, whether it was at Tujeg, Dolly Shoes, Pfister Dental Labs, Leslie Welding, Jagger's Child Stovall, Riley Coffee, and the Book Depository, all of those places were known to have fanatic right-wing conservative management. And there's Oswald in the midst of all of that. And the most curious one, initially, is Pfister Dental Labs. Mm-hmm. Because a witness came forward on the day of the assassination, somebody named Palmer McBride, who was in the Air Force, and he went to the Air Force Office of Security and said, listen, I grew up with this guy, Lee Oswald. Okay, what can you tell us? Well, I remember he was complaining that the Russians had beaten us into space, and Eisenhower should have been shot. Well, when did this happen? Well, it happened when we were working at Pfister Dental Labs. And, of course, to say the Russians beat us into space, causing an anger that meant Eisenhower should have been shot, that's after October 4th, 1957, when he's already been in the Marines almost a year. So when he's in the Marines, he's working at Pfister Dental Labs. And after that note was passed along, in a matter of hours, the Secret Service descended on that place and took away all employee records. And apparently they took away records of a number of places where he worked.
Right.
And we haven't seen him since.
Let me ask you a question about that, because, sure. You know, reading Armstrong's book, you can very easily get lost in, you know, look, forget about his summation. All right.
I have to tell, John, I want to read it again in the English edition.
Yeah. Okay. So you know where I'm going here. Not only is the style with which it's presented a bit confusing, but if you can actually decipher it, okay, you find that there are a lot of these weird overlaps. Now, you just mentioned one where he's working at a dental lab and also in the Marines. And this happens a lot of cases, also with the schools. You got a lot of these overlaps.
Yep. I got one of those coming at you.
Okay, but what I'm saying is when you get into that, I want to know something about your thoughts on this. Because I've always taken it as, I mean, you know, again, not trying to be cruel to the idea that there's two different people here. Cause who knows? I mean, I could be wrong. But it just seems to me as though there are odd inconsistencies in records, like where you have them in New York, but you also have them in another state at the same time, right?
Yeah, if the Armstrong thesis that there were two is inaccurate, mm-hmm. then you have to step back and say, so be it. But there was a clear design to impersonate and to implicate Lee Oswald in a future crime. The signature at the atomic laboratories in the summer of 63, mm-hmm. You know, Lee Oswald, Dallas Road, Dallas, Texas, he wasn't there. There were hotel records, I believe, in Wisconsin when Kennedy was speaking out there at one time. You know, Lee Oswald was staying at different places where Kennedy was nearby, like he was stalking him. There's too much of that. There's just absolutely too much of that. You could say somebody is really setting him up. And I don't think it was pro Castro Cubans or anything like that.
No,
that was homegrown, whoever did it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you there. And when you get closer to the date of the assassination, I see that. But, you know, when you go very far back in his records, though, it's hard to discern exactly. Okay, again, if you remove the idea that there's two people entirely, two entirely different individuals, it just seems that his entire record, either commensurate with the time period or not, is convoluted almost intentionally so that you can't actually sort out, look, I know he was here definitely from this time to this time, like throughout his entire life, it seems like.
I'll be getting to some more of them as we go along.
Okay.
Getting back to the employment situation, when he came back from his travels, and you're talking Leslie Weldon, Jagger's Childs, Riley Coffey, and the Book Depository. In the first three of those businesses, he was known to use Russian comments, you know, hello, comrade, and he was posturing. He was reading red newspapers and just doing little things to call attention to his leftist ideas, but he didn't do it at the Book Depository. And that speaks volumes. Because to me, he might have gotten in trouble. I know Stovall from Jagger's Child Stovall would not provide a recommendation for him. He thought he was, you know, some kooky communist or whatever. But he did not play the red in the Book Depository, which says to me he couldn't afford to lose that job. Mm-hmm. And that's critical. And one question that I frequently get asked is, you know, when was the Texas trip planned? You know, could he have got, why would he have gotten that job on October 16th when nobody knew about the trip? Well, the trip was planned in June. Mm-hmm. And it was publicized. They wanted to have it to coincide with LBJ's birthday in late August, but it couldn't be done. And then Kennedy had a trip out west, Montana, and what have you. And then the Dallas thing was set for the week before Thanksgiving. And if you have enough knowledge about Dallas to know where the airport is and where the Trade Mart is, where you're going to speak, it's easy to pick a motorcade route that's going to be seen by the most people. Main Street, and then you got to make that little jog turn to get onto Stemmons. So he needed to stay in the book depository, whether as a sniper or as a diversion. We don't know. We can suspect, but we can't prove. But that's critical, and it's exceptional because it's not. He stopped being himself for the last. What, 5 weeks? When he was in the Marine Corps, his basic training time is literally a black hole. The Warren Commission essentially interviewed, I can think of four people from the Marine Corps, interviewed. Mm-hmm. A weapons officer, a medical officer who cleared up the Oswald got venereal disease in the line of duty, and then the captain that he served under when he came back to California, and Nelson Delgado. Right. The other people that testified were generally people from California, but nothing is known about his basic training. And that's when you decide, when you're a training officer, is this guy really got the right stuff to be a Marine? You know, has he got the killer instinct? You know, or would he, you know, throw up his hands and surrender if somebody ran up the wrong flag? We don't know. We don't know anything about his training when he went to Keesler in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Very little is known about what he did when he was in the so-called bubble at Aksugi. About what we do know is he saw the aircraft. With his perceptual problems in language, I don't see that guy marking up a plotting board. I would have trouble with that. And you can find time periods in there when perhaps he could have been learning Russian if he had the ability to learn Russian, which I have my doubts because he never learned English. How could somebody with the perceptual problems he had, and they were diagnosed. The Warren Commission sent examples of Oswald's spelling to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, mm-hmm. and said, "What can you? This is the work of a 22, 23 year old. What can you tell me about it?" And what they said, and this wasn't widely published, but what they said was the individual who has the spelling problem is not, and it's not dyslexia and it's not dysgraphia. Those terms are beaten to death. He couldn't see the full field of a word. So if he saw the word independence and he tried to then create it himself, he'd write independence. If he saw the word opinion, he'd write opion, because he didn't always capture the full field. Well, if he can't capture the full field of what he's seeing on a piece of paper, how can he do it at a moving vehicle? Bizarre.
Mm.
One could argue,
though, Walt, that given the trajectory, which is odd that somebody would choose to shoot, you know, taking a look, because, you know, my trip to Dealey Plaza was kind of fascinating to me because, first of all, I didn't understand why they didn't just change the traffic and make it a straight run off of Main onto Stemmons, because that could have easily been done.
There's a reason for that.
Okay.
In the testimony, first of all, you can't go from Main Street directly to Stemmons because in the testimony, in the Warren Commission's questions, they always asserted there was a blockade preventing going all the way down Main Street. They would have had to go down Main Street and hit Industrial Boulevard, which was the seediest part of Dallas, which was pretty seedy itself everywhere in 63, and they didn't want to do that. And the blockade is something you and I would call a curb. And one night when I was in Dallas and I had a rental car, I went down Main Street, jumped that curb, and got onto Stemmons. But Main Street does not access Stemmons. And that's why it had to make that crazy turn.
Well, I understand that, but a temporary ramp could have been put there to facilitate that.
They could have done a lot of things for security, but they didn't do them.
Oh, no, I'm just saying that would have been a more sound idea than the turn.
In retrospect, absolutely. But they didn't do it.
No.
I mean, maybe they didn't think it was particularly presidential, which I think is a little silly. But, of course, Judy Baker tells the story of the Secret Service getting a hold of Oswald and asking him where would be good sites for snipers to hide during the motorcade route. And I think the last person I'd ask that question would be someone who commuted to and from home and work on a bus. But there you are.
Yeah, there you have it. No, I just think that's an interesting question. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to distract from what you were doing.
I mean that whole, you know, they proved there was a rifle there because one of the boxes had a crease in it. Well, no sniper worth the value of a Mannlicher is going to shoot from something that's going to crease when you have a windowsill there that is immobile. Stick the gun on the windowsill, it's not going to move. The book creases, you miss by 30 feet. But that's just me from having been a shooter at one time. Getting back to his school, the Warren Commission actually published two transcripts from the fall of 1953 for the September to December term, which, from it, having been a teacher, I know is about 70 school days. One was from New York City, and he was in attendance, I think, 66 days and missed something like four. The other one was from either New Orleans or Fort Worth, and he had good attendance there. Lee Oswald, same term, same semester, 1,300 miles apart. And in their haste, they didn't realize what they were publishing. Further along in his education, he knew a great deal about Albert Schweitzer College. And he knew enough about it to put a crowbar in his wallet and send him a $25 fee. But when the Swiss Federal Police were contacted about it, they never heard of it. So how does Lee Oswald come along with the Albert Schweitzer College? Because it was essentially a commune with textbooks, period. John Armstrong actually visited the place, driving up roads that are, you know, on cliffs, a treacherous drive to get there, and it was disbanded by the time he saw it, but he saw what had been, and it existed. While he was in the Marines, Oswald was treated for tonsillitis, yet his medical records insist his tonsils were removed when he was young. And I don't know how you get tonsillitis without tonsils.
Kind of impossible, yeah.
If I were the medical doctor you mentioned before, I still don't think I'd know.
No, that's an interesting question. And then when you get into his military record, it gets even stranger beyond the thing you already mentioned, where he's got, you know, a private sector job somewhere while he's fully employed with the Marine Corps.
Right. But, thousands of miles away.
Yeah, of course. But here again, you know, as some people would say, all right, well, that kind of says that there might have been two people, because indeed, while he's in Russia, too, that's another thing that happens. But let's not get away from his military record, or do you have more on his time before the military here, where we're talking about exceptional sort of conflicts in the record?
No, again, it's the school districts. It's, you know, exactly where Mom had him. You know, she remarried when he was six, and that didn't last with Ekdahl, because he wasn't about to pledge his entire troth to Marguerite Oswald, understandably so. And he was spending time in, particularly in New Orleans, well away from where he supposedly lived. Curiosities. Marguerite sold the house where he may have been born to the doctor that brought him into the world. Bruno Mancini. Who knows? Anything's possible. Marines again.
Right.
He has two courts martial. He spent time in the brig. He got a reduction in pay and rank. He was fined 2 months' pay. When he came back to California, he was essentially a custodian at the barracks. But nobody inquired as to what his duties really were there. I mean, he wasn't being much of a Marine. The last time he fired a rifle was May 8th, and he stuck around for another 4 months. And the people that were with him at El Toro were mailed questionnaires by the Warren Commission, and they were asked to submit an affidavit based on the questions. And they were, you know, did you consider him a communist? You know, just generalities. You know, tell me about the guy.
Right.
And I had the good fortune and the misfortune of debating one of those Marines back about the year 2002, Richard Dennis Call.
Oh, okay.
And he revealed, he was retiring from the school where he was teaching. He revealed to the class that he'd been in the Marine Corps with Lee. So he showed up with a bunch of quotes from Posner. I said, that doesn't mean anything. Where's your documentation?
Right.
He says, I don't need documentation. I know he was a communist. I know he was a good shot. I know he hated Kennedy. He hated America. I said, you really believe that? I said, absolutely. I said, did you mention that in your affidavit? Of course I did. I said, well, let me read your affidavit to these 500 kids in the auditorium. Didn't say a word about any of them. I read it. I said, did anybody hear there about communism?
No.
Anybody hear there about a sharpshooter?
No.
And he walked out. He just up and left. So I got to talk to the kids.
Okay. Well, let me ask you two quick questions here. First of all, the court martial you mentioned, is that the one where he injured himself with an unauthorized weapon?
That was the first one, and the sentence was suspended. The second time, he poured a drink over a sergeant in Japan. And the charge was reduced to using harsh words against a non-commissioned officer.
Right.
But it was tacked on, so he served two consecutive brig terms.
Right. They combined them. Yeah, exactly. No, I know the story. I was just curious if it was, you know, when this actually occurred, when he wound up being the custodian, number one. Number two, you ever talk to Delgado?
No, he died in 93. I never got to him. But his testimony is interesting because they keep asking him about Oswald and foreign languages. He says, yeah, Oswald had a real hankering to learn German and Spanish. Hello. we'll get to the Spanish later on. The German is just bizarre.
Well, see, I got to talk to Delgado. I want to let you know something. I got to talk to Delgado briefly. And that occurred in I think, 90. And the reason why I wanted to talk to him is because he was so kind of unhinged, he was paranoid, by the way, about his connection to Oswald and everything, but he was willing to speak a little bit. He really thought people were after him. Did you know about all that?
No, but there's a lot of people that behave that way.
No, I'm just telling you, he was one of those guys. And the fact is that he had said that, I remember this from my conversation with him, that he had he was trying to teach him some Spanish. And he basically said that Oswald didn't get it. It just didn't, like, register with him conversational Spanish.
Yeah, and conversational Spanish is a whole heck of a lot easier than conversational Russian.
Well, that was going to be my next point, is that if you can't go from English to Spanish, you're going to have a hell of a time trying to go to Russian.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, yeah. Okay. But anyway.
My own experience, I tried. I mean, I had to pass tests in German and French for the PhD, and I passed them both for the first time out. Russian? Check, please. When he came back to California, mm-hmm. he had lost his security clearance because of a dual court martial. And again, he was essentially a custodian. And all of a sudden, he's given a test in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried again and again to imagine the scenario. You know, somebody sticks their nose into a barracks and there's a guy with a mop. Hey, you want to take a Russian test today? There's no sense of anybody else taking it. And the other thing, when you actually see the document, he also took a physics test that day and got a 75. And our boy Lee Oswald could not get a 5 on a physics test, even if he put answer A for each choice.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm impressed with the 75, Walt. That's amazing. And quite frankly, I wasn't even aware that he took the physics test. I don't think I ever examined that very deeply. Because
no, he did get a 75, and there's absolutely no way to explain it again except to go back to the theme of the sermon and say he was exceptional or exceptions were made for him. But my question would be, who really took the test? Because I don't think in 1959 he knew enough Russian. I'm not convinced he ever really knew enough Russian.
Well, you know, fair enough. And I know that there's a couple of older guys listening, and there's something related to his military service that you brought up to me just before we went to air. And I've always had a curiosity about it, but never really thought to pursue the question. And I happen to know that a couple of people who have served in the military are listening to us right now. And I would pose a question to you because it's interesting to take a look at his draft card, isn't it? I'm sorry. One second. I had a Selective Service card. Myself, I got it the same year, funny thing, that you destroyed yours, right?
By law. Destroyed mine by law at age 43.
Right, well, and I was 18 when you were 43. So what happened here is that I was required by law to go sign up for Selective Service. Now, no draft, mind you, so it's not a draft card, but it is a Selective Service card. And there was no photograph on my Selective Service card.
There was none on mine, and to my knowledge, he's the only person in the universe that had a draft card with his picture on it, because it had to be inserted in a place where the draft board would write little comments, and I'm sure he did that when he was working for Jagger's Childs doing photographic stuff, which also begs a critical question. He has no security clearance. They're a company that makes maps and does overlays in the Cyrillic alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they making them for? Anybody in the American military would want the map written in English.
Yeah.
So who is Jagger-Child Stovall making these Russian-labeled maps for? Makes no sense. Makes absolutely no sense. And, of course, Oswald was supposedly never able to get near him. But he and Dennis Opstein, who worked there, supposedly went back and forth in Russia. And Opstein had gone to the U.S. Military Language Institute at Monterey for a year. And he was really never pressed into service to use his Russian. He thought Oswald's Russian was pretty good, as did some members of the Dallas white Russian oil community.
Right.
And others said, you know, he was hopeless. And we'll get more to that with him. Again, you know, who took the test and got the 75? I always think it's David Mantic.
Well, really quickly, I want to pause for a second here on what you're talking about, because I have a big question. All the time, I come across these different people who I do concur that they knew him, they met him, they interacted with him, right?
Yep.
On some level. And
yep.
I note that they describe wholly different people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, the fact is there's a couple of universal things among people who knew him. Like, when you said he put a crowbar in his wallet to pull out $25, yeah, that's a hint at something that is universally recognized, you know, in all places except in Miss Baker's work, where you find that he was really stingy with money. And, you know,
him too much credit.
Yeah, I mean,
he squeezed every nickel till a buffalo had hemorrhoids.
Yeah, right. But the weird thing is, like, you can come across certain universal things, but then the extreme differences that you hear in what is being described about his behaviors, his posture, his knowledge, his ability to speak, his ability to write in English, Russian, anything. It
yep.
seems like people could not have be talking about the same person, even though you know for a fact.
Absolutely. But beyond that, there are universals. He's 5 feet 11, but he was 5 foot 9 at autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
You only get one eye color. Yet when you put his eye color documents together, he had gray, gray-green, green, blue, hazel eyes, which... All right, there's some wiggle room in there. Aileen Mosby interviewed him in the hotel in Moscow
mm-hmm.
and told about how he pierced her questions with his steely brown eyes.
Yeah, see now eye color's
That's
a little ambivalent though, Walt, because you know there are people that have those eyes that are so reflective that people do describe him as different, and they wind up, you know, with the hazel description. That's usually what ends up, you know, as their overall description
yeah.
for their eye color.
Right.
I'm not saying it's super common. I'm just saying there are.
In some cases, he provided the eye color and the difference.
Yeah. There's the funny point, right, where, look, eventually you would just say, look, my eyes are hazel. And other people's descriptions might vary on that, quite frankly. My mother's
Absolutely.
Eyes.
I don't think you're going to say brown.
No, that's the thing. Like my mother's eyes were what she called hazel, and they were those types of reflective eyes, where you know sometimes people saw them and thought they were blue, other times green, and sometimes brown. And that was just one of those things, you know.
Perception has to be given its place in any understanding of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm walking Casper out front and somebody goes by on a unicycle dressed as a clown and is juggling oranges, and somebody calls me 2 hours later and says, what's going on? I said, you're not going to believe what I just saw. Well, they wouldn't believe it. Are you sure? Yeah, it only had one wheel. It was a clown, and he was juggling oranges. Well, could they have been tangerines? Oh, come on, please. Perception.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's critical. It's not always perfect. But sometimes, here's a matter of perception. First of all, when Oswald was in the brig, that extended his tour of the Marines. That didn't count as time served. So whereas he had enlisted in mid-October, he wasn't due to get out until some point in December of 59. But he got a hardship discharge, and he got it in an exceptional way without any documentation to support the hardship claim. Marguerite Oswald changed jobs several times after the box of candy fell on her nose. And each time she changed jobs, she went to be examined by the company doctor to say, you know, look, I'm disabled. I can't do this. Nobody signed off on it. Nobody found anything that was disabling. So he got that discharge with no documentation whatsoever. And I would like some researcher to find other people that got hardship discharges from the Marines with no documentation. Sure, if the rest of the family is killed in a tornado, you can get a hardship discharge, but there's documentation. Mm-hmm. And he had none. And once you approach the hardship discharge concept, and we don't know when exactly he approached it. We only know when he got it. There immediately should have been a hold in the State Department against him getting a passport. Just as a matter of course. Hey, we don't want this guy getting a passport. He's getting out of the Marines with a get out of jail free card to take care of mom. He shouldn't right. be traveling. But he got the passport. And if they wanted to get rid of him, they could have given him a general discharge. You have honorable, less than honorable, undesirable, and dishonorable. He got honorable discharge. Mm-hmm. It was eventually changed to undesirable with him in Russia. Why not the bottom rung? Dishonorable. He was in Russia. He didn't go to the reserve meetings. You know, he literally betrayed his country. Right. But, again, you know, were there other Marines that took off for other places, walked into the embassy and threatened treason, and, got a slap on the wrist? He was going to fight that to the death because of job applications. And nobody at any point in time, if they say you served in the Marines, we want to be discharged, yeah, of course. They don't ask for a certificate. And if they did, he had an honorable discharge certificate.
Right.
It wasn't like he had to give it back.
Right, but even his journey to and from Russia provides us with some really, really fascinating, exceptional stuff.
Oh, yeah. I got him.
You know, so and meanwhile, I want people to remember this, though, just for context. You're talking about a guy who only lived to be 24 years old.
Yes.
So, you know, this is a lot. Barely. I'm just saying. Barely. Right. He was only, a month past his 24th birthday when he died. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm like a month and a half, I think. Right. Because he was born October.
He was born October 18th. So it was a month and 6 days.
OK, fair enough. So,
Casper. Go get your bone. Go on.
Of course, Casper has something to say about this, too, because, you know, why not?
He was in a video called The Searchers, and he was the hit of the video.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a great documentary. Randy Benson, who's been on the show and talked about it, actually. So,
yeah.
Good.
I think I mentioned Gerald Posner and Casper howled at the moon. Worth a look for that. The Marine officer that testified about Oswald's shooting ability was Colonel Allison Folsom, mm-hmm. and he had Oswald's marksmanship scorebook in front of him, which said, all right, he fired this course, you know, here's his history. And they said, how would you characterize him? And he said, I would characterize him, quote, a rather poor shot. Mm-hmm. The Warren Commission turned him into a sharpshooter. And the backup of that was one rifle range record. The, come on, The demarcations were 190 for marksman, 210 for sharpshooter, and I believe either 230 or 240 for master. In one record, he got a 212, which would be sharpshooter. But the listing was MM, which is marksman.
Right.
So either the 212 was wrong or the MM was wrong on a very highly official military document. Come on, you got to stop this. He got seasick on his trip from New Orleans to Le Havre. And when I read that, I said to myself, a Marine getting seasick? There was no mention of him being seasick in any time he was in a Marine, and sometimes he was in rough water in small craft, or on his paid trip home from Holland to Hoboken, New Jersey. But he was seasick going to Europe. He knew the best route to get to Russia through Helsinki. Was that common knowledge? I mean, I seriously tend to doubt it. And I doubt that the Marines sat around and said, if he wanted to go to Russia, what's the best way to get there? Airplane. He went. Helsinki. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, he had a six-day visa for his visit. And this, again, goes back to the crowbar in the wallet. He purchased 10 days of tourist vouchers, and they were $30 bucks a piece.
Right.
Which would have meant four of them would have gone to waste. And that's $120, and that's Lee Oswald. But, you know, you had the fake suicide. And if somebody can't kill themselves from a distance of 2 inches, I have trouble with them killing anybody with a rifle. But he stayed. Of course, at the end of the 10 days, for people who are allowed to stay, the price drops to $3. Mm. But the first 10 days are $30 a day. While he's there, initially, Priscilla McMillan, you know, the CIA sent her running to him. And she has the unique distinction of being one of the only, if perhaps the only, journalist ever expelled from the Soviet Union.
Right.
But it was either her or Eileen Mosby that he told he learned Russian through Berlitz. Berlitz, at that point in time, was a series of records, phonograph records, where they'd say, where is the bus stop? And you'd have to, and then they'd say it, well, in this case, in Russian. And you'd have to practice, where is the bus stop?
Right.
But you're not going to learn, you are not, absolutely not going to learn survival level foreign language from Berlitz.
No, and they did this for many languages, not just Russian, but, you know, the French, Spanish,
absolutely.
German, you name it pretty much. And, yeah, it would be, you know, where is the bathroom? And then they would say it in the native language that you were trying to study, and then to another phrase, you know, and this was repetition again.
The where is the bathroom question, the next one would be, do you have prostate problems?
I don't know if that was on those records, but,
it would have been on mine. Berlitz is limited tourist talk, and Richard Snyder at the embassy was convinced Oswald he couldn't even do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he could have played a game with him, who knows. But I would think if Oswald goes in there and says, I've applied for citizenship, I know stuff that they want to know, he would have been rattling it off in his very best Russian to prove his bona fides. But he didn't. And the same thing is true when he was arrested on November 22nd. At some point, or in the debates that summer, at some point he would have shown off, because he loved to show off what little he had, he would have shown off his Russian. but he didn't.
See, and again,
there were record albums came out. Oswald Speaks, and it showed him at the press conference saying, "Nobody asked me that." There's not a drop of Russian on those records.
No, I've never
heard Lee Oswald say anything in Russian. He had plenty of chances, and certainly in front of Snyder. Boy, that was bonanza, and he didn't do it.
Well, see, that's a funny thing, is back to the exceptionalism of Oswald. And I'll tell you, one thing I'd love to be able to hear is the rest of the tapes that Ernst Titovitz has. If somehow somebody could convince him to transfer the rest of the audio tape he has of Oswald, it would be nice, because I think that he did do some Russian speaking on there, and it would be nice to hear exactly what it sounded like, because there is no record of it anywhere.
I'd be curious. The interesting thing, as far as that goes, Titovitz wrote a letter to Lee and Marina in the United States in January of 63.
Mm-hmm.
And the Warren Commission dated it January of 61. Make no sense to write a letter to Lee and Marina in January of 61 when they weren't married yet,
mm-hmm.
and they were in Russia. But it was sent to it's two-sided. The first page and a half is in Russian, and it mentions your baby's going to be a year old soon, which was January 63, and the older girl would have turned a year old in February 63. The first page and a half is Russian. The half page at the end is to Lee in English explaining what Titovitz wrote to Marina in Russian.
Right.
And that's awful strange. That is very strange. But there it is. And of course they had to dummy it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, absolutely. And another thing is, you mentioned Snyder. And by the way, we've almost gone through the first hour. I don't know if you want to take a break and continue, or if you'd just like to keep running. But, you know, you mentioned Snyder there, and you want to talk about exceptional. According to legend, he makes these statements about turning over his knowledge to the Soviet Union. And he's going to defect and all this other stuff. And, you know, Snyder, who is clearly connected to the CIA...
What
does he do with the passport that Oswald throws on the desk, puts it in his drawer? He doesn't process it. He doesn't inform the American government that basically you're going to need to, prosecute this guy or anything like that. He just throws it in the desk drawer. I mean, like.
He did send a cable to the State Department.
But. He has the guy's passport. He doesn't, return it to the U.S. government and say, seize this guy's passport. Don't let him back in. You know what I'm saying? I would think that you'd have to do something with it.
The other thing along the same lines, which I was about to get to next, Oswald was there when the embassy was officially closed. But Snyder's there and McVicker is there.
Mm-hmm.
Once he said what he said, he could have been arrested right there in the embassy, because technically that's U.S. soil and there are military personnel in the embassy.
Correct.
For exactly situations like that. But, again, Oswald's the exception. His travels were noted in the U.S. media, in Texas at least, which treated him as a defector to the USSR. You know, Fort Worth's native son defects to Russia. The CIA did not open a file on him until December of 1960.
Mm-hmm.
A year and a month and a half later. And simple question, why not?
Well,
and
yeah, because...
What he did...
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, McMillan, who is reporting to the CIA about him, we now know from new documentation... Okay, and Snyder, who is CIA, encounters him in a way that should generate some interest and create that initial person of interest 201 file. Right then and there, it doesn't, allegedly. They didn't start that file until that point, later on, much later than those events, right, in Russia.
Yeah. Well, Snyder sent McMillan. Whether or not he sent Aileen Mosby, I don't know. The Russians at one point did something to try to turn her because Snyder got a phone call in the middle of the night and said, you better come and get this American woman. She's someplace in Moscow, butt naked. And he's got to pick her up, wrap her in clothing, get her back to the embassy and straighten everything out. That never happened to Priscilla. The whole Russian thing, it was a game. People say, yeah, well, he was sent to work in a radio factory. That radio factory also made experimental radar, which supposedly he knew something about. We don't know if it was ever discussed, broached, but we don't know. It's a black hole.
Right.
He got married in 61. And this is unacceptable. He got married on April 31st. He never learned that 30 days have September. But if you think about it, the day after April 30th is May Day. So
you know,
maybe he was going to send, you know, I led three lives kind of coded thing.
Well, see, now there's a curious live question here, actually, in the chat room related to exactly what you're talking about, but they asked it before, and they want your opinion about whether Marina was specifically put into his life for, like, as a plant, due to the fact that her uncle had a connection to intelligence there in the Soviet Union.
The uncle was a colonel in military intelligence, the GRU, which is more severe than the KGB at that point in time. And he went to work. He went to work in a uniform. And when she was asked, she said, well, he works in forestry. Yeah, he hides the missiles in the trees.
There you go.
I don't. It's easy to suggest that she was, because there is a lot of people seriously believe that she spent time with Robert Webster, and that her English was a whole lot better in Russia than it was in the U.S.
Yeah.
And it would make sense if she tried to get attracted. And then he makes the world, you know, her oyster by saying, you know, look, we're married. By the way, I want to go back to the U.S. Because he had already started the process. Come back when he got married, but he didn't tell her.
Right. Well, the exact question is, you know, was she basically planted on him by the Soviets in order to return to the U.S. with him? That's the whole question.
It's entirely possible. If I had to come down on a yes or a no, I'd say yes.
Okay.
But I don't have the documentation to prove it. It's a hunch. It's everything I know about her. It's everything I know about him. Because there's some strange, I mean, talk about exceptions. They had a fight one night. They had a fight more than one night.
Right.
She went out and screaming. She called a woman named Elena Hall. She got a cab, went to her house, and stayed there for a week. One, where's Marina? Got the money for the taxi. Two, how does she make a phone call to get a taxi? Three, where does she give them directions? Take me to Elena Hall's house? I mean, that's like somebody saying, you know, well, Walt Brown lives in Hillsdale. It's a little town, but still. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous on faith.
Right.
But we're just asked to believe it. And she could not be given a U.S. entry visa in the Soviet Union. Because a country can't grant an entry visa unless the two countries have mutual extradition treaties, which we didn't have. But the State Department waived Rule 243 parenthesis G to allow her to get the entry visa in the Soviet Union, which is rare.
Yeah, no, very rare. But another fair point, I think, okay, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's equally plausible, given the fact that she had encountered more than one guy from the U.S. that, you know, was likely to be returning to the U.S., she may have truly been in search of, you know, her own escape route and really, truly just wanted to...
It was the U.S. State Department. Mm-hmm. That granted the exception, not the Russians.
Right.
When somebody comes here from Russia, they don't go through anything Russian. They go through the U.S. Period. There was something else about that.
Well, it's just because of Webster.
When she got here, mm-hmm. when they got here, I mean, the Texas white Russian oil community pretty much didn't take to Lee Oswald at all. But their biggest curiosity was, how did the two of them get out?
Mm-hmm.
That was foreign to their understanding, totally.
Well, and to add to the exceptional exit, you know, or exodus from the Soviet Union, one of the things that's always been striking to me is how it is he acquired the money to get home, because you know that it's just because you have permission doesn't mean you have money.
Well, I got that next. But okay. Here's the thing: he should have had money. We know he was getting well overpaid at the radio radar place.
Right.
She had a job. They were playing nickels and dimes for rent. They should have had a nice little nest eggs to sit on, but. According to the History of the World by Earl Warren, they didn't have a dime, so they had to borrow $435. The curious thing is the head of the State Department, who, in terms of that transaction, was Frances Knight, a woman, who was as rabidly anti-communist as anyone you could imagine, and she would deny a passport to anyone who owned a red car or liked fire trucks. Anything red, no good. You're not getting a passport. You're not getting whatever you need. And she was eventually taken and sued in federal court, and she lost. Hmm. She was told, play the game. Play the game right. When they got back, he was met by Spas T. Rakin, who was another one of the single most anti-communist people in the USA. Mm-hmm. He was an elected official of the anti-communist government of Bulgaria in exile. I think he was secretary treasurer of the government in exile of Bulgaria. And he's the welcome wagon?
Right. This guy who defected to a communist country, I'm sorry, and brings in tow a wife who is the relative of a colonel in military intelligence in the Soviet Union. Let's send the anti-communist guy to go greet them at the dock.
Yeah, let's give him a laughing welcome. His works are in the Hoover Institute, Herbert Hoover, out in Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in 100 volumes. 99 of them still exist. But that's it. Casper, go easy. You're a good boy.
yeah,
the historic diary was a resume event. He had $10. He paid somebody to have some of it typed. She said she'd finish it for nothing. He said no. He took what was done, and he took the carbon paper. So he's playing the spy, the I Led Three Lives again, which is strange because his brother Robert, who threw him as far under the bus as Ruth Payne did, mm-hmm. Made a point of saying, well, two things. One, when I was just before I went into the Marine Corps, I used to see Lee sitting in front of that TV show, I Led Three Lives, and he was loving it. Robert Oswald went into the Marine Corps in 1952, and the program debuted in October of
53. Of course.
As we know, the last time the three boys were together, Pick, Robert, and Lee, was Thanksgiving of 62, which happened to be November 22nd. And Robert claimed that, yeah, you know, I'm not surprised that Lee was involved in all of these things because, you know, he deteriorated horribly over the last year of his life. Robert never saw him for one day in the last year of his life. He didn't see him till it was a year and one day, and he got to look at him through a window in the jail.
Well, he did, yeah, he got to speak to him, you know, phone on one side, each of the glass,
yeah.
You know, that sort
don't
of circumstance.
Believe the so, don't believe the so-called evidence. Yeah, a gun, mm-hmm. a palm tree, and the whole government rigged against you.
Yeah, so that's what occurred there. Now, a curious thing about that meeting where the three brothers are together in 62, you do know that there is a piece of, like, home movie footage that exists of this. And it's rather curious because you don't have a lot of home movie footage of Lee Harvey Oswald except that one particular day. And did you ever see that?
No.
It's rather innocuous. There's nothing like, revelation. There's no revelations in it, you know. It's interesting to actually know that's one of the very few pieces of home movie footage that exist of Oswald.
Yeah. So Pick did not recognize him, and he was a little put off when Oswald introduced Pick to Marina as his half brother. He'd never done that before.
Right.
And that was, who knows, the money order for the rifle was purchased in the hours of the late morning when Oswald was at work at Jagger's.
Wait, can I rewind something with you really quickly, though?
Sure.
Because we talked about the loan from the State Department for him to travel.
Right.
I would like it very much because I love this, and I've heard you tell this story before to somebody and watch the look of shock on their face. I love the way you explain how it was paid back because it is the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
Could you please do that real quick?
$435.10, I believe, and he started by paying a certain amount and 10 cents. Now, if you owe $435 or 70 cents, whatever it was, you're going to pay $100, $100, $100, $100, and then when what's left, you pay that off, the $35 and 10 cents or 70 cents. He paid that part off first. Then he went after the rest. It makes no sense.
Well, not only that, but
he needed $200 to get from the boat to Texas, and Robert put that money up.
Well, the funny thing to me about that repayment is, you know, look, you might say to yourself, if you're looking at something as a debt on a ledger, let me pay the odd amount off and then I'm dealing with round numbers after that. But what's funny is that really quickly after the first small payment, he just pays the rest of it off. Right? I mean.
Well, he didn't pay it off in one shot.
Well, no, but it's really quick.
Yeah, it was quicker. He paid it off more quickly than his income dictated.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, is you can't actually find him making money. I mean, listen,
no.
Plenty of people make money off the books. So, I mean, there's always possibilities here.
Ask Judy Baker.
Yes, indeed, ask Judy Baker. But anyway, here's the thing about this. You know, it's like if you take a look at what his income was on the record, it doesn't seem as though he should have been able to pay off the $400 or whatever that was left in the amount of time he paid it off, which is weird also.
You know, he's got that debt. He's got $200 to his brother. He's got a wife and a baby. And that's not an inexpensive load to be carrying when the best you're hoping for is a buck and a quarter an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, the crowbar and the Wallace syndrome. When he got hired at the book depository, he wanted his withholding to be four dependents, himself, Marina, the daughter, and the one that was going to be born in a few days.
Right.
That's nuts. I mean, what's it going to save him? 30 cents in those days in income tax? I mean, he's making $50 a week. So how much are they taking out? It's crazy. Back again to the money order. Mm-hmm. Again, and this is according to John Armstrong, the money order for the rifle was never endorsed in any manner by Kleins, where it was. And when the U.S. government got it after November 22nd, there was still no endorsement on it, even though they were making weekly deposits in the tens of thousands of dollars. The odd thing about the rifle, of course, is it was sent to a post office box in the name of Lee H. Oswald. It was addressed to Alec Heidel. Package should never have been delivered. I tried it. I sent a letter to a name I made up at my post office box. Never got it. Of course, that could happen. That could happen with normal mail nowadays. But
yeah, well, listen, if you're telling me you did it, you know, this year, Walt, I would say,
Years ago.
Okay, but if it was this year, I mean, listen, that's no metric to go by, but because things are crazy with the mail right now. 20 some odd days it takes for me to send something to New Jersey from Georgia. Okay, just so you know.
Yeah.
If I'm lucky. So next time I buy a book from you.
I'm still getting birthday cards, and one was from Mom and Dad saying, "Wow, you're 10 years old. How you've grown."
Thank you, Mr. DeJoy. Anyways, postmaster.
There was no purchase of rifle or pistol ammunition that could ever be traced to Oswald, and every gun dealer in the United States knew what Oswald looked like. Mm-hmm. But none of them shipped anything to Oswald or Heidel, and the clip didn't come with the rifle. And it wasn't found with the rifle.
No, but, you know, I have...
Of course, it shouldn't have been.
I have seen statements from people that worked at Kleins that said that, you know, they did send along ammunition with weapons enough, you know, to load the weapon, and that was it. So, I mean, some ammunition could have been in his hands from the initial purchase. If you accept that the purchase was made, it was delivered at the post office box, et cetera, which is really weird because, again, the money order is not endorsed. The deposits, now, there's a certain thing about how the deposits are listed with Kleins, and there's arguments over that record. But again and again and again, you've got convoluted records that just don't show a clear chain of custody, a clear chain of events. I mean, it's like a constant theme with this guy.
The key to finding that money order was Harry Holmes. He looked at the thing and said, "Wait a minute, you guys are looking for something that's 1995 and he had to pay shipping." Mm-hmm. They didn't figure that out. So then they started looking for a money order for $21.45, and lo and behold, there it was. Mm-hmm. The pistol is even more bizarre. The ad for it demanded 50% payment in advance. It was a $30 pistol.
Right.
Oswald sent a third, $10, not half, which to me meant they send them back. They put a stamp on an envelope and send his check back or whatever he sent. But they sent it, the pistol, by Railway Express. And that's a company that could not deliver to post offices until very recently. Folks like FedEx or DHL or Amazon or anybody, only the United States Postal Service could deliver it to post offices. Mm-hmm. And certainly Railway Express in 1963 could not. To make it even crazier, it was sent as a COD, which your listeners probably don't even remember. It meant cash on delivery.
Right.
Who paid for it?
Well, that's the thing.
The post office didn't put out the money.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you delivered to a post office box, now look, COD used to be, you know, somebody shows up at your door and you had to pay them. A lot of times they did take cash, and in some places they wouldn't take cash. They had to take checks because, you know, bad neighborhoods. But either way, you had to pay them when they showed up, cash on delivery. And you can't do that with a post office box. I mean, it's just...
The postal guy didn't do it.
Yeah.
So following the weapons collection, Oswald was fired from Jaggers on a Saturday, meaning they paid him overtime to fire him. This doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
Then 4 days later was the Walker event, after which he buried the gun, dug it up days later, and it wasn't rotten from being in the ground. While he's working, when he goes to the land of Judy and he gets a job, he's still collecting Texas unemployment, you know, without any big deal being asked, but he wasn't making a lot of money, Riley Coffey. And the unemployment was $33 a week, and that's unimaginable. I collected unemployment back during the 2008 meltdown. I think every check was like $468, and that was very sweet, thank you. The CIA file that was opened late, there were overlapping files. There was a Lee Harvey Oswald and a Lee Henry Oswald. So right. You have plausible deniability. Oh, no, we thought that was Henry. Was it Harvey? He should have never been given a second passport. But he got it in one day. And if you look in the Warren volumes, the page listing showing the passports, next to his name, and all the other names are redacted, next to his name are the letters N-O. Well, that was explained as that means New Orleans. But there weren't letters next to anybody else's name. And they're all redacted. They didn't have addresses. And if they were John Q. Citizen, why redact their names?
Mm.
It had to, you know, because somebody, the guy in the bar where he threw up, he got a passport at just about the same time. And one of the guys that worked at the trademark, the guy that took the photos of Oswald outside the trademark, got the passport with a travel visa ahead of him. The Riley Coffey employees got promoted to jobs at NASA. Oswald got promoted to Patsy. Oswald is interviewed by an FBI agent in an event that ended up in a $10 fine for one defendant. Unimaginable. Absolutely unimaginable.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing that winds up getting him to. You mentioned the whole Oswald Speaks record albums. Well, that was created from the interviews that, you know, he was a person of interest. Interesting guys connected to Inca and all those other wonderful things going on there. What was it? A guy named Ed Butler, right? And
yep.
Interviews
he was,
him.
He was connected to Inca. I'm not sure Oswald was, because Inca was very anti-communist, and he's fair play for Cuba.
Oh, no, but Butler running, that's what I meant, is that Butler is connected to Inca. He runs a radio show at that time called Latin Listening Post. And that was, I believe, what those record albums contained also was that.
Yeah.
That interview.
Bringer was involved with that. Butler and Stookie.
Yeah, that's
it. One of them, not Bringer, but one of them took Oswald out for drinks after and, you know, felt sorry for him.
Well, there's two interviews here. One of them is for Latin Listening Post. The other one is for WDSU. And the WDSU interview, Berenguer is there with him. That's, you know,
that's when they ripped into him as a commie.
Well, it was funny because, you know, look, you're a communist. And he says, no, actually, I'm a Marxist-Leninist. And he's asked, what's the difference?
Well, you wouldn't understand.
Well, he didn't understand either because he starts going into these odd explanations about how many TVs there are in Russia as opposed to Cuba and, you know, what the difference is in the amount of sugarcane being traded for machine parts or whatever. Like, he's going back and forth with these very weird observations and never really explains if there is a philosophical difference between being a Marxist-Leninist or a communist purely.
Yeah, he's pretending to be an economist, and he's trying to be a politician. And on that subject, he orders 1,000 leaflets for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee thing. And 1,000 leaflets is what you order when you have a lost cat or you're having a car wash. Mm. Not something to incite a political revolution, and certainly not something that you hand out next to a United States warship with sailors coming off it. I mean, hey, if this didn't get me beat up, what am I going to have to do? I got to go to Brigadier's store, pretend I'm on his side, and then do something stupid. Good boy.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, there's all that, right? And like you said, the situation with the fine, and the, you know, no, sir, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, and all this stuff going on. Curious, when it comes to all that, and of course, now you're into, by the way, they love that you brought up the land of Judy. That's a hell of a phrase, by the way. but anyway.
Disney's going to make it an attraction.
Yeah, well, back to reality, because this is a very curious time period, and he's got this situation where he's, you know, handing out these leaflets. He gets in this, you know, little public thing, winds up paying a $10 fine. Okay, fine. The other guys he's fighting with in the street, by the way, not charged. They walk out of there.
They got a
go ahead.
Cruz, Hernandez, and Bringer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it matters, but and all he did was be the object. You know, he started it when he talked back to them.
Well,
when he was arrested for that, I think it was Francis Martello in New Orleans asked him about the Corliss Lamont pamphlets that Oswald had. And he said, "Well, what do you think of this guy?" And Oswald, being pedantic or sophomoric, corrected him to say that, by the way, Corliss is a she. In fact, Corliss Lamont was male, and Oswald didn't even know what he was handing out.
Yeah,
Lamont's great nephew ran for the Senate a couple of years ago in Connecticut, and Corliss Lamont was one of the people that sued the State Department for the right to get a passport when they weren't giving them to Reds.
Well, see, and a fascinating thing here, he's built a, you know, he said he was the treasurer, I think, of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. First of all, according to the records, he never actually formally joined the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The chapter he's talking about did not exist. But here's the other curious thing. All of this stuff to build this communist legend, if you will, right? If you believe half of what's described up to this point in his story, quite frankly, Walt, here's a curious fact. He never joins the American Communist Party, so therefore, he's never been.
And that's easier to do than registering as a Republican or a Democrat.
No, absolutely, but here's another part of that I think people forget about. He lived in the Soviet Union, right? Well, guess what other communist party he didn't join, even though it might have been helpful to him while he was in the Soviet Union? He didn't join the party there either, Walt.
No.
So, I always find that rather exceptional as well. I am a communist, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, I'm all these things, and yet never actually joining the organization, or even, we don't even know if there's any evidence that he ever attended a meeting or anything, do we?
Well, he absolutely hated the fact that after work at the radio factory, he had to sit and listen to somebody spout communist propaganda for an hour or an hour and a half, and he wanted no part of it.
Well, there's that, but what I'm saying is he never actually went to one of the meetings. You know what I mean?
No, because if he went in Russia, he wouldn't have gotten out without being a member. And there's no somebody that would have seen him at a communist meeting in the United States would have ratted him out.
Mm-hmm.
What's surprising is that with all the talk we had about the two Oswalds and the imposture or whatever, nobody claiming to be Lee Oswald went to a communist meeting. jumped up and said some stupid things about whatever. Who knows?
Well, I'm just saying, here we go with another exceptional point that there, for all of the communist legend building that's occurring here, whether you think it's a manipulation or the agency was using him or he was just doing this in order to, you know, live out his My Three Lives fantasy, it doesn't matter. He never actually goes and joins the Communist Party. Like, he never takes that step.
No.
So.
He did some mailings to get literature from the Socialist Party.
Right.
I think in New York City or Baltimore, but not the Communists. All right, I'm going to finish up in our time. The people who saw Oswald's living accommodations took note of pro-communist literature. They saw, you know, the Karl Marx books. Mm-hmm. But they never saw anything, for instance, how to speak Russian, Russian dictionaries, nothing like that. And when the extensive search of the Payne house, the only thing that was found in any kind of foreign language sense was a cheap Spanish dictionary.
Right.
But that's in Russian. Sylvia Duran gets arrested on the orders of the U.S. government, is possibly tortured, and then rearrested because Oswald met her on his business in Mexico City, if he went. Did she have other arrests and tortures for meeting guys in the consulate or the embassy, or was it only for Oswald? Why wasn't Richard Snyder arrested? Why wasn't Spaz Rakin arrested? Nothing. Oswald's New Orleans post office box was closed after he left New Orleans for good. And that's something you do in person. His written English, as we know, was generally poor, particularly in spelling. I think he made sense out of what he was trying to say, but he didn't spell it well. His Russian spelling, and I had someone check this very carefully, who had been a resident of Moscow for 41 years. His Russian spelling was near perfect. It was better than 95% of what Russian people could do, and it involved little tweaks in the Russian language that Russian people don't even use, but he had them. And that was what I was basing it on, was the Walker letter, which was Commission Exhibit Number 1. How many native-born U.S. people could be as good, could be as bad in English and as good in Russian as Oswald is a wide-open question. Oswald seemed to be a man for all wallets. For a guy with no money, he had a lot of wallets. He left one at home at the Payne house. He surrendered one when he was arrested, and he was thoughtful enough to leave one at the Tippett scene.
Right.
In case anybody missed him, he was given a press conference on Friday night when they asked him if he shot the president, and he said, nobody asked me that. And it was a setup, basically, for, hey, look, we're not beating him up. Which was part of the excuse for televising his transfer / execution, which should have never, ever been public, but he was the exception. And last but not least, and then we'll deal with questions and whatever, John Pick was not allowed to attend the funeral because he was still in the service, and he would have come in a military uniform. Excuse me, and that was vetoed. And Pick needed Pick needed permission from the Secret Service to telephone Robert Oswald. And that's bizarre.
Well, very suddenly, the family of the alleged assassin is under Secret Service protection, right?
Yep. Well, yeah. Mom and Marina.
Yeah, well, Mom, Marina, baby. right?
Yeah, babies.
And what was going on? That to me is also exceptional, don't you think? Or do you think that's, I mean, obviously there were people that certainly would have been angry and might have sought to, you know, exact some sort of vigilante situation here. So I can see it as logical, but I don't know if that's normal. Have we ever seen another presidential assassin, alleged one or whatever, that had their family protected while they were being buried? Or anything like this in the past? Are you aware of it? Because I'm not.
No. But Booth, I believe, was single. Charles Guiteau was certifiably nuts. He was the lone nut. He's a story unto himself.
Yeah, right.
He acted as his own lawyer, and he insisted he only shot Garfield. The doctors killed him. The sepsis. He browbeat everybody in the courtroom, including the jurors. He was given the death penalty. He wrote a poem to read on the gallows, and he wanted an orchestral arrangement to go with it. He was allowed to read the poem, but the orchestra, like Guiteau, was left hanging. And Czolgosz was a kid. I don't think he had family. I mean, Oswald was a kid, but he had family.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. But, you know,
Czolgosz's execution is on YouTube.
I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of that. Wait, where you've seen that on YouTube?
Yeah, they had to juice him three times.
Yikes.
Before he was dead.
And then you have the really curious interesting distinction for Gerald Ford, two would-be assassins that were women. Right?
Sort of.
You got Elmore and you got Squeaky Fromm took a shot at them both, right?
Sarah, Ellen Moore and Squeaky.
Yeah.
But I also turn your listen. If your listeners are going to YouTube, look up Alexander I of Yugoslavia, 1934. It's a preview of the Zapruder film. It's absolutely incredible. He got on the ship and went from Yugoslavia to Marseille. He was met by a French foreign minister. The two of them are in a back seat of a black limousine in a motorcade. There might have been a couple of motorcycles, but most of the guards were on horseback. Somebody breaks through the cordon, jumps on the running board of the limousine, and shoots Alexander dead. The cops then rush to the scene and they shot, by accident, they shot the foreign minister dead. And the killer also shot the chauffeur whose foot got jammed under the brakes of the car, just sat there. And there's these two guys, dead as a Thanksgiving turkey, sitting in the backseat of a black limousine. It's about 3 minutes long, but it's amazing.
Wow.
Alex, and it was a Tuesday, and Alexander I was superstitious because he'd been involved in some tragedy, so it happened on Tuesday. But that was his last Tuesday tragedy. Amazing stuff on YouTube if you wander around sometimes.
Oh,
which
no.
Which I don't regularly do.
But yeah, well,
I've seen those.
See, that was an interesting thing, too, is that recently I got an email from somebody who had happened along on some of my older videos on YouTube asking literally about your stuff. I passed along the message to you regarding the Deep Politics Quarterly because I was showing that and one of your books in a video. I think it was the Warren Omission. And I don't remember which issue of Deep Politics Quarterly, which used to be a really interesting paper, you know, thing that I would get in a large envelope, you know, a quarterly in my mailbox. And I remember discussing it on YouTube, you know, probably 12 years ago or something like that. And somebody wrote to me about it and asked if there was a way to get a hold of the old copies of.
Yeah, that went through probably four computers from 1990, 95 or 96 up till 2019. And when I restarted it, it was essentially as a favor to somebody who had been a friend named Tim Smith, mm-hmm. who sent me an email that he was dying, and I sent him, but he was still giving JFK talks, so I sent him boxes of books. I said, sell them, and we'll split whatever you get. Well, he sold them. I sent him money for his birthday. I sent him money for Christmas. He still has boxes of my books, and he doesn't even return emails. And I was carrying him on the journal. We discussed an idea. He said, yeah, I'll do it up. And he did 3 pages of nothing, unfortunately. And I said, enough. I can't do it all myself. I got to print them. I got to stuff the envelopes, the stamps, edit his stuff. No, can't do it. And it's a shame because I always enjoyed doing it. It was fun. But it happens. I've gotten inquiries about back issues, but I only made the number I needed because it was never a cash cow, not by a long shot.
No, over the years when I went to your house, it was, there was never extra copies of the journal laying around. They just weren't there.
Because between the printing and the mailing, you're looking at $4 and change, and I had to send letter after letter to people who were subscribers and remind them, hey, your subscription's up. Oh, yeah, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And I made some wonderful friends doing that. I really did. I can't say enough about the people that I'm still in touch with, many from 1995. Yourself. And it was a worthwhile experience. And of course, the chronology just shot articles out. I mean, they just popped into the journal. Mm-hmm. So that was an easy thing. And of course, the chronology wrote the Judy Baker thing.
Right, which again is available. Not, you know, you can get a digital copy of it. You, the listeners, not you, Walt, but you have one already. You can get a digital copy of it, sure, online if you like. But I suggest actually that you contact Walt and get a physical copy of the book, and you're also willing to sign it. Quite frankly, I really do think if you got somebody on your Christmas list that is interested in the Kennedy assassination for sure. Or would like to see a dissection of sometimes interesting claims from people who are given, you know, to appear as though they might have been eyewitnesses to history, which, by the way, the JFK case is riddled with people like this who have questionable to laughable assertions relating to their involvement in the case. It's not the only time in history when people have sought to make themselves part of history when they're not, or change their role. But fact is that it's really a fascinating read. And again, although sardonically she might be the co-author of it, quite frankly, it's Walt Brown showing you with her own words and the known evidence on the case that not so much validity maybe to her claims. Anyway, yeah, there's that.
I don't think he ever flew David Ferry's plane. I don't think the Secret Service found him in order to get the best look-see on where a sniper would be. Mm-hmm. And my favorite, I'll never get past this one, he was tortured by the KGB, but he stood up to their torture. So the KGB apologized and gave him a nice apartment.
Okay, one random question.
There are two words you never put in the same sentence, and they're KGB and apology.
Apology, yeah, right. Apology? Okay.
The KGB, in its day, for what it's worth, was the most efficient killing machine that ever existed.
Fair enough. A random
hostages taken, I don't know, I'm going to say 30, 35 years back, somewhere in the Middle East. There was Americans and Russians. And we negotiated and we promised to give them weapons to do whatever they want. The KGB went in there, found out who the ringleader was, got the guy, did things to him that we're not going to talk about on the radio, but which raised the pitch of his voice quite a bit, and they dropped his dead body on the door. The next day, the Russians' hostages were released, and then we went on negotiating.
Yeah. No,
they did fool around. And just as a commercial, I have the KGB in the new novel that just came out. It's called The Nero Order, which is something Hitler ordered at the end of the war to destroy all of Germany. And it's brought up to the modern day, and the spies are still out there, and they're still killing people, and they got to be stopped. But it's a fun book, and the first few people that have read it have loved it. Best they ever did. Oh, come on. I've done better. No, you haven't. But it's fun. The Nero Order. It just went on Amazon today.
There we go. Brand new work.
Christmas present for a real fanatic. Get the chronology.
Yeah, no, that too. That was the next thing I was going to say is, you know, you want to give somebody basically a library in one piece. You can get one of those CD-ROMs directly from Walt.
Nowadays, I don't watch much television. Mm. But what I do watch is you get pharmaceutical commercials the whole time. And if you can't afford your medicine, so-and-so may be able to help. If you can't afford the chronology, I may be able to help. I'll never turn anybody down. If they want five of them for presents, we can deal. But I would be very happy to have that information out there.
Right, in as many hands as possible. So look, before we run completely out of time, I've got one random question from the chat room, if you don't mind, for you.
No.
And it is, what are your general thoughts, really in short order, about Beverly Oliver and her claims about being the babushka lady? Because I've done a few shows on it. I know why they're asking. I've done a few shows on it where, you know, Walt, I really feel as though she ain't it. But that's my view.
There are photographs taken, I'm going to say, within 60 seconds of the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And the babushka, which is how they pronounce it in Russian, the bee lady, is standing on the north curb of Elm Street. She's not out in the weeds anymore. But it's the trench coat and the scarf. And it's a woman who looks to be about 40 years old with dark, unwashed hair. Mm. And there are a couple of pictures. The other thing I would say, and I love Beverly Dealey. She sent me a nice birthday card 2 weeks ago. If Beverly Oliver was at the Kennedy motorcade at age 16, 17, looking the way she did, she would have been out there in a bikini, waving to Mr. President. She wouldn't have been covering up everything with an overcoat and a scarf.
Well,
so that's my. You know, I go on the photographic evidence because, to me, it's convincing.
Well, see, on the photographic evidence, Walt, I think if you search it very carefully, you'll find there are multiple women with the babushka because there is more than one pattern of babushka. There's more than one woman with a babushka, and I'm sorry to say I concur with you.
None of them are Beverly.
Exactly. That's what I came up with, too. Okay, so we have answered that question. But once again, I'm going to provide with the podcast and also put in the live chat room when I'm done broadcasting here the links, Walt's email address, and, you know, a lot of different titles. Do you have any other books, too, besides the Kennedy Execution, the Judy Baker book, the Chronology, the new novels? Sorry?
Warren Omission.
The Warren Omission, you still have those.
I have a CD-ROM index that I did a number of years ago that I give everybody that buys the Chronology. It's 2,400 pages. It's a little out of date, but it could help.
No, it's very helpful. I have a copy of that as well.
Particularly if you're looking for references to people in the older books. because the stuff that's coming out now, I saw an advertisement for a book that said The Umbrella Man took the Zapruder film.
Oh, geez. I just,
you know,
I got nothing for you on that. I don't know what to say.
Too long and too hard and too honestly on what I've done to even get close to that. The one book that I am really looking forward to coming out and getting a good look at is Josiah Thompson's book. I believe it's called The Last Second in Dallas.
Mm.
I know pretty much what's in it, and it's fascinating. And I will absolutely get it and read it. But this other stuff, you know, the Fetzer with his lawsuits, and I can't. Judy Baker's newest book on...
Yeah, I know. I'll tell you another one, and I'm sure you would say it would be worth a look. That is going to come out and is going to be serialized on the Mary Farrell website is going to be from Larry Hancock.
And, okay.
You know, there's a guy you would say, I'm sure, is worth a look. You may not know the contents of the book, but whatever Larry writes, right, is something that you know is going to be written sensibly. It's not going to be the Umbrella Man shooting the Zapruder film and, you know, exploding.
It's really tough. The umbrella's going up and down.
Well, you know, listen, if you combine that with the fact that there was an explosive in the seat and, you know, David Ferry may have indeed been the guy in the doorway at this point, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I'm losing.
He was praying in the doorway while somebody was shooting from the trunk, which is a tough call because the plastic bubble top was in the trunk.
You know, true enough. And besides, I don't know how he got out of the way for Clint Hill. But you know, again, I don't have this sort of imagination. But anyway, once again, Walt Brown has been with us now for 2 hours almost, and we didn't even take a break. I am really happy with what we did, though. I appreciate it. It's like the exceptional world of Lee Harvey Oswald, or Lee Harvey Oswald, the truly exceptional American, something like that. We're going to title this episode. But either way, I advise that you get any of Walt's work. How much is how much might somebody be able to acquire a Warren Omission for?
$30.
If they take a package,
it gets discounted. Everything.
Okay, so The Warren Omission is an older book, guys, but is one of those things that is absolutely go-to. Matter of fact, it is the basis for which I often make the statement that sometimes you might want to call the Warren Commission the Dulles Commission. The reason is revealed in The Warren Omission, where Walt actually shows you who the active members of the Warren Commission were, and things like this.
The statistics make it overwhelming that it was the Dulles Commission.
Precisely. But this is where the assertion comes from. Just so you know.
Yep.
Okay. I learned this from Walt. I did. But
that's wonderful. We'll do it again sometime soon. Hopefully, I won't have to wear the mask.
And hopefully
barking.
Hopefully Casper will bark more on cue. There he is.
Take care, and thank you to your listeners. It's always fun reaching out to you or answering your questions.
Absolutely. Thank you, Walt Brown, and thank you guys for listening. Anyway,
and be safe.
Absolutely.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com.
Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com.
Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get the results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Ocelli.com.